Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Iran's former president Sayed Mohammad Khatami meets Pope Benedict XVI here in the Vatican. Stay with us over the next half hour for background and analysis of that visit and why some soldiers want out of the war in Iraq. And in our top story today, former Iranian President Sayed Mohammad Khatami was here in the Vatican Friday to meet Pope Benedict XVI. The two spoke of the importance of a serene dialogue between cultures with the aim of overcoming the serious tensions of our times. A Vatican statement following the talk said they also spoke of promoting fruitful collaboration for peace and the development of all people. They spoke, too, of the status of Christians in the Middle East and in Iran and the need for robust international commitments to finding a peaceful solution to the conflicts across the Middle East. They also expressed hope for the positive outcome of the international conference underway in Sharm el-Sheikh. Well, President Khatami was in Rome to participate as a keynote speaker at the conference Intercultural Dialogue, a challenge for peace, organized by the Pontifical Gregorian University. Speaking at that conference, Mr. Khatami urged Christians and Muslims to rediscover their common heritage as monotheistic religions, solidly rooted in love and justice, as a basis for improving relations. He also said no one can use God's name to instigate war or hate. The conference was co-sponsored by the nonprofit organization Anastasis, which is currently collaborating with Iran's culture ministry to restore the 18th century Armenian Catholic Church of Our Lady of the Rosary in Isfahan. Vice President of Anastasis, Antonella Catani, was instrumental in arranging President Khatami's visit to Rome and the Vatican. She spoke to me outside the conference ahead of the president's audience with Pope Benedict. I began by asking her just how many Christians are there in Iran today.
Not more than 5,000, more or less, and different type of Christians, Armenians, Assyrians and Catholic are very, very few.
And what is their relationship with the rest of the mostly Muslim community, the Shia?
Well, in Iran, there are a historical presence and they are an identity of Iran. They grow with Iran and Persia. So I think that Iran will getting poor and poor if it's losing the Christians, because the Christian identity in Iran is very rich and ancient, is part of the history of Iran.
Now, through this project that you have launched in Iran, reconstructing a church, restoring a church from a few centuries ago, you were also instrumental in bringing President Khatami here to the Vatican and here to Rome. Could you explain that?
But it is very important to the relation between Iran and Vatican. Iran is very sensitive on cultural project. That's the reason why we ask Mr. Khatami to come and to introduce the new aspect of dialogue between Vatican and Iran. Because in this moment, it's very difficult to have relation with Iran, open relation. And Khatami always try to introduce a dialogue between civilization. That's the reason why we asked him and invited him at this conference, a dialogue like a challenge for peace. Really, for me this word is very important, because it is a challenge, that cultural dialogue, that culture makes all the human more near. And the dialogue on the cultural heritage is one concrete act to build peace.
What do you hope comes out of this encounter?
Of Mr. Khatami? The first, I will be very, very happy to see that Mr. Khatami will give the hand to the Pope. Two hands of very intelligent persons. and very sensitive persons, very spiritual. It's very important this moment. It's a sign for all of us. And after this, to build really a dialogue with Iran, not like bad countries, you know, but a country that is open for dialogue, in the dialogue. And we have to bring Iran into the dialogue. We have to try all the doors to find the way to dialogue with Iran, because Persia is a wonderful country, wonderful persons, and I think it is a hope for all the world that we can, if we can dialogue between. And the Pope will dialogue with Iran, the best person of Iran. And this respect to Iran, we have to take care, because I think it's very precious today, this open door from Vatican. And with our work, we try to stay on this road and build dialogue.
Antonella Catani, vice president of the non-profit association Anastasis. Jesuit Father Samir Khalil Samir teaches Islamic studies and Christian-Muslim relations at St. Joseph's University in Beirut, Lebanon. He spoke to me about the significance of President Khatami's visit to the Pope.
Khatami is certainly one of the most open person I met. A few months before his election as a president, he spent some days in Beirut, and I had the opportunity to meet him with five other Christians for 2 hours in Beirut about Christian-Muslim relationship and through the history and today and so on. And I really admired his openness. He studied also in Germany, so he has an open vision. He knows other languages. And I remember, for instance, that someone from the Christian side was speaking about the Crusades and saying, yes, we Christian, we did very bad things and the Crusades, and we attacked the Muslims. And he answered and saying, but this was not a religious war. This was a normal political, financial, and so on. He presented exactly the opposite vision coming from him. It was really a shock for me, a very positive one. And in every question, his vision was a more historical, open vision. We had great hopes when he became president. The problem is, unfortunately, that the president in the Iranian system inaugurated by Khomeini has practically no power. He is totally depending from the imam, the religious authority, which is over everyone. So he deluded a little bit the people and those who elected him, because he couldn't change a lot. He changed something. He introduced a new approach, more open to the West and to non-Muslim points of view. And this is his vision. He's more a philosopher. So I think here, this is really his argument, dialogue of cultures and religions. And he means that we can overcome the conflicts by reflecting on how to live together, having different visions of the world and having different cultures. He opposed the conflict of cultures by saying there are different cultures, but they are not necessarily conflictual.
President Khatami was one of the numerous Muslim leaders to attend Pope John Paul II's funeral in 2005.
He wanted to say, this person, John Paul, has made so much for the peace between peoples and cultures and religions. He wanted to say we also, as Iranians and as Muslims, especially Muslims, Shiites, Muslims, that we want to be here. Together we are building another world, another vision of the world. And he was personally very committed to this dialogue. He promoted it in Iran, and many, I know an American Jesuit, Father McDermott, was invited twice by him in Iran because he wrote his PhD on a Shia theologue, a Shia thinker, and was invited to Qom, the holy city, to speak about this great thinker. And he met personally the president and discussed with him. And this is just one example, but the same happened often. In his time, they invited people from the Gregorian University, priests, to teach in their theological faculties, to teach Christianity. And they are interested in such a relation. The same happened for me in Lebanon, in St. Joseph University. We had in the last years people from Iran sent by the government to study in our St. Joseph University and to make their PhD. There is a great openness in Shiism in general, more than in Sunnism, much more, but they are difficult political relations. These are two different things. The politics is run by some people. Culture and religious aspect by others. They have an interpretation of the Quran which is open to metaphysical and mystical and allegorical interpretation. But you will find also a very strict application of the Sharia. We heard that last week they have taken some women in the street because they were not strictly dressed. Mm-hmm. You have both tendencies, a political one and a religious open one.
It looked like Khatami was trying to implement reforms. He was considered a moderate by many, especially in the West, who was trying to implement reforms of the government and the bureaucracy. But are you saying now that things have changed dramatically after he left?
Certainly, with Ahmadinejad, things changed. But it is also true that he wanted to implement reforms, but did few things, simply because, as I said, the system does not allow him to do all what he would like to do. But the system is also controlling the excess. In the other side, the excess of Ahmadinejad. He is not able to do to go too far in his strict interpretation and in his nationalism. Iran remain an open country, even if they have a closed system. But even the clerics, you find different tendencies. Now it's a more closed one. But I see, for example, in Beirut, in Lebanon, in the Shia community, you find one of the many of the most important clerics, Sheikh Hussein Fadlallah, for instance, Ali al-Amin in the south, they are all against Khomeini's vision of the so-called Vilayat al-Faqih, the supreme authority on earth of the clerics, so to say, the specialists of the law, the divine law. This is the position of Khomeini is very consequent. He says, God gave us the Sharia, which is the best law on earth because it's divine. So how to guide a country? Certainly by applying the Sharia, the divine law. Who could best guide people to apply it? The specialist of the divine law, that means the clerics. So it's very logical. But something is failing, that politics does not mean only divine law, means economy and diplomacy and technology and so on. And what I'm saying, many imam in the Shia community are saying, they don't attack the vision of Khomeini frontally, but they will say this is only an aspect. And this more open vision is broad enough, but not, they don't have now the mainstream.
70% of Iranians are under the age of 25. How representative of that huge amount of population is this government of Ahmadinejad and also the clerics?
In the beginning, this government had a strong support from youth and from the mosque and from the commercial sector. With the time, and we have seen that a few months ago, how he lose his authority in the university, certainly, but also by many youth and even in the commercial sector. And why they were enthusiastic for him? He is defending national values, especially in front of the strongest nation, the United States. So this was also a reason why many people were supporting Ahmadinejad, because he was the strong man against the strongest nation. It's a question of
national pride.
National pride.
But you say now that things have changed.
Yes, because they see that the financial situation is not good. For instance, with Ahmadinejad, Iran helped a lot all the movements in the Middle East and in Asia with money. Hamas, which is a Sunni, Palestine, in Lebanon with Hezbollah and so on. Well, all this money is money taken from Iran. So they feel something is going wrong. Ideology is against the daily life. That's why he's losing a great part of authority.
Of course, in the region, we have the war in Iraq. Last year's war between Hezbollah and Israel ended pretty much in Hezbollah's favor, which, of course, has been backed by Iran and Iran's nuclear ambitions. What does this mean for Iran as a regional power?
In the Muslim Sunni world, Iran and the Shia are for them the greatest danger, more than the West, because they see how strong the Shia movement is growing and growing against the Sunni movement. You mentioned Iraq. Certainly, it's a revolution because they have the demography, the numbers. The same is happening in Lebanon. In some countries in the Gulf, you have also the Shia growing. Growing in number, growing in money, in power, and growing in ideological influence. The Palestine movement, which is a Sunni movement, for tens of years did not produce any positive effect. In 2 years with Hamas, helped by Iran, everything changed. So even Sunni Muslims are admiring the Shia. This is something dangerous for the Sunnis. And I noticed when I speak in Lebanon with Muslim people, all the Sunnis say, be careful, don't go with Shia, they are very dangerous. We can better live together, you Christians and us Sunnis, but you cannot live with Shia, and so on. They feel from all sides, and with the nuclear power, certainly, Shia is the new power in the area.
Jesuit Father Samir Khalil Samir, Professor of Islamic Studies at St. Joseph's University, Beirut, Lebanon. In Iraq, it seems easier to die than to live, given the unprecedented wave of hatred and violence sweeping the country. That comment came from Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, the Holy See's permanent observer to the UN in Geneva, who appealed to the international community to do more to achieve reconciliation, dialogue, and peace in Iraq. The war in Iraq is now in its fourth year, while more and more Americans are opposed to the war, as the violence shows no sign of abating. There's also an increasing number of American troops who have served in Iraq who are now registering as conscientious objectors. One such man is Joshua Castile, who worked as an interrogator at the notorious Abu Ghraib jail in Baghdad, where U.S. troops were accused of abusing Iraqi detainees. As Joshua explained to my colleague Susie Hodges, his move to register as a war objector was closely linked to his decision to convert to Catholicism.
Well, I served a total of 8 years in the U.S. military. I served as a U.S. Army interrogator at Abu Ghraib from June of 2004 to January of 2005. And not only did it take me 8 years to come to the conclusion of conscientious objection, but it also took a deployment into a combat zone. So this was a very long and difficult journey of conscience for me.
Have you been criticized by your former military colleagues or your family and other people you know for your decision?
The military has not been aggressive against me from all I've gathered so far. I've received a good amount of heat from my extended family, however. I come from a very nationalistic, evangelical Christian household with significant numbers of, especially my father's side of the family, having served in the military. But most of the people who criticize me for my decision have never served in the military. And that's a very common phenomenon, that usually it's the people that are the most dogmatic without any experience that throw the most accusations.
Your decision to become a conscientious objector also coincided with your conversion to Catholicism. Can you explain very briefly, you know, what pushed you in that direction?
The textbook definition of interrogation is to exploit the greatest amount of intelligence in the least amount of time. And when I was deployed to Iraq, although I was politically quite unhappy with the war in Iraq, I didn't quite have an ethical alternative in my mind, a clear one. And reading especially the literature of Pope John Paul II and then Cardinal Ratzinger played a significant role, as did the writings of Dorothy Day, Thomas Merton, St. Francis of Assisi, Ignatius of Loyola. But John Paul II said things like, whenever you reduce a person as a means to an end, as an object of exploitation, you participate in the culture of death. And I had countless experiences in the interrogation booth where my job was to do precisely that, to view them as an object of exploitation, not as a person who was on a journey towards God, hopefully. And what I wanted to do was be able to look at a person as a person, not as a target through my sights, and not as the mere means to a military end.
Were you very shocked by what you found at Abu Ghraib? You know, of course, you came in the wake of the scandal, the abuse scandal, but also it wasn't a particularly clean atmosphere, was it, even when you were there?
Oh, it was terrible. We had 12,000 detainees at Abu Ghraib when I arrived, and over 90% of these men were completely innocent. We would go into the villages and have mass sweeps where we would arrest every single male above the age of 14 in order to find a handful of people. The detainees slept in canopy tents, while I slept in concrete shelters, which is a direct violation of the Geneva Conventions, because detainees are supposed to be given the same amount of protection from violence that soldiers are given. We were bombed on a regular basis, 5 times a week, and throughout the entire 6 months that I was at the prison proper, I don't know of more than 5 coalition soldiers who died, and yet as many as 45 detainees would die over the course of a single day because of attacks upon the prison.
And, I mean, what was the attitude, then, of the US troops towards these detainees?
Well, the policy of the prison and military intelligence was skeptical of every single person who came into the prison. Individual soldiers remained rather skeptical, or cynical, more like. But they simply went about their job. They did what they were told. But you don't have to be an interrogator for long to realize that the people you're talking to are taxi drivers and schoolboys. And that takes a huge toll, not only to your morale, but to your soul.
So, I mean, you came to the realization that what you were doing there was wrong.
Oh, certainly. And the way that most interrogators dealt with it upon return to the States was drinking. Find a way to numb the pain, to numb the memories, and to get on with life.
Do you feel that if you hadn't had that experience of going out to Iraq and working at the Abu Ghraib prison, that you might not have become a Catholic?
Well, John Paul also said that in the work of Providence, there's no such thing as mere coincidence. I certainly can't play the diviner of my history, but the war played a profound impact in my development of faith and conscience, and I was given the opportunity shortly after I left Iraq to come and view Pope John Paul II when he was laid in state. And when I came into St. Peter's Square and I saw Christ at the top, surrounded by 5 apostles on each side, and then Peter and Paul down below. Peter is only holding the keys, and Paul is only holding the sword of the Spirit and the scroll, which is the Word of God. And I thought, and we were surrounded by hundreds of thousands of people waving flags from Bolivia and Poland, all over the world. And I said, this is what the kingdom of God is aspiring to be. We're the people that offer truth and salvation. And we have a fidelity that transcends the nation state and can be an instrument of peace throughout the world. And I said, that's what I want to be a part of.
So do you now feel more at peace with yourself?
Well, I've eliminated a certain amount of cognitive dissonance, but it's incredibly trying to be a conscientious objector, to be a Catholic, especially in a country in which 30% of the armed forces are Catholic. When I entered the military, and I've given this oath 3 or 4 times, I raised my right hand and I said, I swore allegiance to the Constitution, I swore faith in the Constitution, and to follow the orders of those appointed above me. Now, in the Iraq War, techniques of interrogation like induced hypothermia, where you strip a man naked during winter, pour ice-cold water over him, put him in front of an air conditioning unit, and then repeatedly take his rectal temperature, that's legal. That is legal according to the dictates of those appointed above me. I'm fully fulfilling my oath when doing things like that. And for me, it's an incredibly trying moment to know that this is happening and to know that my friends who came back from Iraq, some of whom were on 6 separate medications for post-traumatic stress disorder, are being given very little encouragement and tools to resist, to say that I don't have to do those things simply because a person above me said so.
And that was conscientious objector Joshua Castile speaking to Susie Hodges. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.